Welcome to From the Booth, a podcast hosted by the International Cinema Program at BYU. I'm Chip Oskerson, and I'm here with the co-host, recently returned from the Hong Kong Film Festival, Mark Yamada.
Glad to be back.
How was your experience at the festival?
The festival was a lot of fun, whirlwind experience, as they often are, right? But really great festival, well-run, organized, 44th year, I think, Hong Kong Film Festival, so pretty well-established festival by now, so it was really good.
Does it tend to specialize in Asian cinema, East Asian cinema?
Yeah, I mean, there seems to be a couple things going on. One is you're getting kind of this curating of some of the best of European cinema, of kind of the festival films. And so a film, Cold War, that we showed here from 2018 was kind of a headliner there. But you're also getting that attempt to kind of showcase the more regional directors, so you're getting some of the themes of like pan-Chinese, pan-Asian cinema. That was kind of a main theme there as well. But also films that are produced in, you know, France or Germany that deal with kind of Asian issues. There was a documentary, a French-made documentary on Cambodia. So really kind of interesting mixture, really reflecting in some ways, I guess, Hong Kong itself as this, you know, traditional gateway between the West and the East, maybe, you know, with globalization, that's kind of broken down a little bit. But there's still that focus with the films that are shown there. So some really interesting films.
Were there one or two films that really stood out to you as
there was,
you know,
a really
knockouts?
Cool film about smuggling iPhones from Hong Kong back into China, which, you know, ironically, they're made in China and they have to be smuggled back in. So it was kind of an interesting heist film, but it really dealt with some of these larger issues of globalization and this new rich culture in Asia. Interesting in that way.
So interesting to watch this in Hong Kong too, right?
Yeah, yeah. And so you're, you know, you're kind of seeing all this kind of take place. So, yeah.
That's great. Okay, well, we'll hear a little bit more about some of your experiences maybe in a future episode here. As we do every week on From the Booth, we will spend the next few minutes talking about the films that played at IC last week and then turn to preview the coming week's films. As we discussed last week's films, we'll assume that you've seen them and will not give any spoiler alerts, so if you're worried about revealing important plot points, you can use the time codes we provide to skip ahead to the previews, where we promise no spoilers. The films that we'll be discussing today include Transit by Christian Petzold, a German and French film from 2018, The Sea Inside by Alejandro Amenábar from 2004, a Spanish-language film, Daughter of Mine, an Italian film by Laura Bispuri from 2018, and then The Judge, a documentary from 2017 in Arabic. So let's go ahead and start with Transit. This is a film by Christian Petzold, who we've showed several films by him at International Cinema recently. He is a good example of what has come to be known as the Berlin School of filmmaking, that these are younger filmmakers that were all trained in Berlin. They tend to be focusing on social issues. There's a turn towards realism in different kinds of ways, issues of work and employment, conflicts between life and death, this kind of thing. Petzold's probably the foremost of all of these. He's made a really big name for himself with films like Phoenix, for example, from a few years ago. This film, Transit, is based on a 1944 novel by Anna Seeger, a novel by the same name. And what's really interesting, I think, about this film is the way that it highlights issues of migration. That's at the core of it. The basic plot is that we're in a modern-day France. And this is actually one of the interesting things about the film, too, is the way that he fuses a World War II novel and idea. France is occupied by Germany. And it doesn't give any explanations why this is happening in kind of modern day. We don't get that kind of context. We simply understand that Paris is occupied. And the main character needs to get out of, Georg, he needs to get out of Paris. And it's at the last possible moment that he's escaping down to Marseille, where he's hoping to secure some kind of passage outside of France. Marseille is not yet occupied. And so it very much has a Casablanca kind of vibe to it. And the whole film is straddling a contemporary context with a 1940s aesthetic. So the main characters dress in vaguely 1940s kinds of clothes. The way that people are stuck and don't depend on technology is reminiscent, again, of the 1940s. And yet all of this is in contemporary Marseille.
Right.
And it really serves to highlight, to fuse together, I guess you can say, the kinds of issues that we associate with World War II, the rise of fascism, kind of the repression of minorities, right? I mean, the Holocaust, you know, even. and contemporary politics, the rise of neo-fascism today, right?
Or refugee culture.
Refugee culture, yeah. And so this is, I think that this is the real power of the film. And I think that for me, what was particularly moving in seeing this film again is the way that you really kind of get into the characters and feel their, you know, the problems of being alienated from home, right? Yeah. And not knowing where you belong
kind of
at all.
This in-betweenness, right? Of not really being able to get to your destination, but not really being able to settle into where you are and not even having this identity that's your own, right?
That's right, yeah. That this limbo, I mean, it truly is this kind of limbo, and there's this sense of impending doom, right? That's kind of closing in. And the inability to extricate oneself from that physically or psychologically kind of is working both ways. You develop an enormous sympathy for these characters and the plight that they're in.
And also the ironies of thinking that you're going to escape and finally getting to where you're going, and then of course being met with some kind of tragedy, right? With the mine that they hit as they're traveling out to sea, and so
that's right. Yeah, so the boat that they should have been on in the end right. ends up going down at sea, and they're left with a kind of survivor's guilt as well, right? That, you know, why have we survived when others, you know, kind of haven't?
Right.
Something that gives this film some added complexity. I mean, that is one of the things I really like about Petzold. Is he did this as well with his film Phoenix. There's lots of mistaken identities. I mean, it really helps to foreground, well, what is identity? Where does identity come from? The main character, Georg, takes on the identity of an author who committed suicide in Paris. And at first, he's there to just kind of hand over the documents and the manuscript, you know, from this dead author. But right away, the consul in Marseille assumes that he is the writer. And in a split second, he has to make this decision, oh, if I take on his identity, I can get his visa, right? And I can, right. You know, I can escape to Mexico, which I love too, right? He's not going to the United States, he's going to Mexico,
right.
Which I think is significant. And in the process, he's been reading this manuscript, and life and fiction blur in interesting and complex kinds of ways as he becomes the author Vital.
Right.
And to me, it helps to highlight that this is just not a straightforward question on any side. Deciding to leave where you're from comes at enormous cost. Psychologically, you know, who you are and what you are, it's tied up with place and with experience. Mm-hmm. And so it develops in me as I'm watching this. I can't help but think about all the refugees kind of moving around the world. In most cases, most of them don't want to be where they are,
right.
That they're there not by choice, but of necessity. And that changes then a little bit how I think about my responsibility towards them, right?
Mm-hmm.
That a lot of times they're portrayed in the media as opportunistic, kind of greedy, trying to take our jobs. In a lot of cases, these are people that are trying to survive as well.
Right. No, that's for sure.
I really like the bold colors. I like the camera work in the film, too, that takes you through this. This is, you know, I think probably my favorite film from the week.
From the week, yeah. Beautiful setting, too.
Which yeah.
Belies in some ways the themes and the topics, but yeah.
That's right. Daughter of Mine is the film by Laura Bisburi. She's a young Italian filmmaker born in 1977. And this is a film that really highlights issues about adoption and about motherhood. We had a great lecture by Professor Marie Orton from Italian who helped to draw our attention to some of these.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I wasn't there for the lecture, but for me, watching this film is really just kind of paying attention to the dynamics of the characters and really this kind of understanding of what motherhood is, right? Because it really seems to be something that's almost redefined and reworked as the film goes on. Maybe never even really settled into a definition or clear understanding of what it is even by the end. But the film involves a young girl who has two mothers. One is her biological mother, younger mother, whose life is a little bit more of a mess. And
ironically named Angelica, right?
And her adoptive mother, who's very protective, kind of the ideal mother, we're led to believe at first, and we have this huge discrepancy between the two of them. But as time goes on, it seems like in some ways that these maternal instincts that we see from the adoptive mother could possibly be kind of interfering with the growth of the young girl. And ironically, the biological mother, who puts her daughter in harm's way a little bit more, is almost the thing that she needs to kind of take that next step into womanhood and to move past maybe being a girl and kind of go through the rites of passage. And so I thought that was kind of interesting way to think about it. I remember we had Bruce Fink here, who's a Lacanian scholar. He came and gave our Bridge lecture, which we give in the comparative arts interdisciplinary humanities section every year. And he said something really interesting about growing up, this idea that in some ways trauma is necessary, that we think of trauma as something that can kind of limit you. And of course, to a certain degree, it can. But there's a certain amount of trauma that's necessary in order to kind of take that next step, you know, as you're right. kind of growing up. And I think you see that here, that in some ways, Angelica represents maybe that traumatic element that kind of gets her out of her comfort zone, allows her to kind of move forward and take that next step. It's really interesting film. By the end, you get this, in the ending scene is really interesting because you have all three of them together. And there's this kind of interesting flux of identity going on where they take turns being the mother and the daughter and the one who's, you know, protecting and the one who's helping and being protected. And
yeah.
And it never really kind of settles in to...
Yeah, there's a fluidity, right?
A fluidity at the end.
Between this that leads to a complete lack of resolution.
Right.
Which is the point, right?
I think in some ways is the point.
It's not that one mother is the preferred mother over the other, that there's elements of both that are, like you're saying, necessary.
Yeah, and she kind of goes back and forth between the two, and then she's also kind of developing herself. And so really interesting, in some ways goes against the grain, I think, of what we think is motherhood and how this need to be this protective mother can also be in some ways limiting
right.
from a perspective of a parent, right, who wants to kind of shield your children from all the different harms and dangers of the world. It's kind of an interesting way of thinking about it. So.
Yeah, the way that Professor Orton casts this in her lecture, she kind of drew on upon Nietzsche in talking about the Apollonian versus Dionysian kind of tendencies.
Yeah.
And in thinking this way, it's not that the Apollonian is necessarily preferred over the Dionysian. You know, to embrace one over the other,
right.
you know, is really problematic, that it's this productive tension between
yeah.
these, the ordered and the structured versus the, you know, a little bit chaotic and spontaneous,
yeah.
right? And so she was kind of reading the mothers in terms of this, that there's a productive tension,
yeah.
you know, that exists between the two of them.
I really like how she shoots them, and she'll have this conflict between maybe two of the characters, and then one will just kind of walk off, and you'll have this kind of long tracking shot of her kind of walking away from the situation, and you kind of wonder what, you know, what's going on back there, and it kind of leaves that tension going a little bit, and even towards at the end, you know, you don't have this resolution, but there's this kind of back and forth, which really seems more, in some ways, productive than kind
yeah.
of being settled into to one particular identity or one particular role, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, Professor Orton also made the point that adoption in Italy is a much more contested concept than it is here in the United States, that we're a little bit more comfortable with it, maybe
right.
because we have a different kind of sense of identity and belonging, you know, oh. here in the United States. But in Italy, it's very few official adoptions, actually, every year.
Yeah.
And so the fact that, you know, she's adopted is... You means know, something else there than it
and
maybe
I guess
is
so,
for us.
There's never this transferring of rights, right? I mean, there's this,
yeah.
and so that kind of leads to this ambiguity and this back and forth. I think that's interesting that the United States is like that we have a little bit more of a need to kind of talk about custody and rights and things like that. In other countries, there's a little bit more of a sense of fluidity in that way. So.
Yeah. She quoted the director, Laura Bispori. The director said that she was interested in what makes a woman be a mother, and what does being a mother make a woman?
Mm.
I thought that was you know, an interesting way to think about the film, too, about
yeah.
how motherhood
yeah.
is actually affecting these women as well. It's not just the effect on the daughter,
right.
But also how being a mother or not being a mother or trying to be a mother, you know, changes these figures. This is an interesting... I don't want to necessarily call it feminist cinema because I feel like that categorizes it a little bit too much, but
right.
but it certainly is exploring some really important dimensions of gender.
Mm-hmm.
And I look forward to seeing more films by Bispori because this is an interesting take, an interesting approach that I think will, you know, I'm interested to see where she goes with it in the future.
Yeah.
Another film that highlights the role of women in society, this is part of our Women in Politics series, was our documentary, The Judge. This is a 2017 documentary by Erica Cohen. Erica Cohen is actually kind of local product. I think she grew up in Salt Lake. And it focuses on Khulod al-Faqih, the first woman judge to be appointed to the Middle East Sharia courts. So the Sharia courts is where a lot of domestic issues are handled. And this is in the West Bank, so in Palestine. And I think one of the things that really comes out from this film, I mean, to begin with, she is such a remarkable woman
really
to,
is,
you know,
yeah.
to kind of take on this, you know, this role and to take this mantle upon herself with a lot of opposition. Of course, it's not a given yeah. in Palestinian culture that a woman should be playing this type of role. And she does it with a self-assurance and grace that's not angry or militant, but resolute.
And, yeah, and she commands respect.
She really does.
When people come in, men will listen to her recommendations, her judgments.
Well, and you think how valuable, and this is going back to the discussion that we had about RBG as well, the film about Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Our lecturer that week made this point about how valuable it is to have different life experiences sitting as in judgment, that it's not that women necessarily execute the law differently, and in fact they shouldn't, right? That there should be a right. certain objectivity to the law. But what's really valuable and important is a greater diversity, and especially when you're dealing with the kinds of domestic issues that the Sharia courts focus on, divorce and, right. and custody and things like this. It's really important to have someone who has experienced the other side of, you know, the gender divide.
She's a mother and she has, I mean,
that's
four
right.
or five kids, you know?
Yeah. And she makes this point several times in the film too, that you know, because she's a woman doesn't mean she's more emotional, doesn't mean she's no. more, but it does mean that she understands what it means to be a woman right. and understands that side as well.
And you see that objectivity as well. I think part of Sharia law, I think, is this idea that one of the tenets is that there's this fundamental, you need to obey your husband, which I think is something that's kind of built into that. And, you know, she'll ask the women, are you following that, right?
Mm-hmm.
In some ways, that's kind of supporting that idea. But then you see how interesting it is that marriage, in some ways, is not this really oppressive thing, but there's a certain kind of negotiation that goes into it, right? The whole marriage contract, which
yeah.
is fascinating to me, this idea that you can actually write in certain stipulations, right? If you want to finish your doctorate as a woman and you're getting married, then you can write that into your contract.
Right? Yeah.
You don't want your husband to do certain things. And so
yeah.
I came away thinking less about this idea of marriage as this oppressive institution and more of it as this negotiation, this interesting way in which men have to follow the rules as well, right?
Yeah.
They have to live by the rules as well.
Well, yeah, there has to be kind of equality under the law, right?
Yeah.
That's right. We had a really interesting discussion as well with Professor Donna Lee Bowen from Political Science and Farah Odebat, who is a judge from Jordan who's currently studying here at the law school. She's getting a master's in law. And she's a judge in Jordan, and Jordanian situation is a little bit different. They've had judges there for a little bit longer. In her case, she's not in the Sharia courts, but actually in the civil courts. And the theme that kept coming back in that discussion was, what do we do when the major problem is not the actual law, right? There's nothing in the law that says that women can't take on these kinds of roles, or in the actual religion, right? Rather, it's these societal attitudes. And this is something that the film brings out, that they kind of interview people on the street, so to speak, about their attitudes, that should a woman be doing this or not? And some of the things, you know, the people say, you're like, oh my goodness, I can't believe you would say that to a camera. It's just, it's so, you know, kind of bigoted and biased. But these are societal attitudes, that these aren't actually hard-coded into, like I said, the law or even the religion.
The more open interpretation that, as we see.
Yeah, and that's there's something that I think that we can all learn from that what, you know, looking at all of our own traditions and say, well, what are the kind of the essential and the core points versus what are some of our societal attitudes? And in what ways are some of those societal attitudes biased against certain groups? And can we rethink that in productive ways?
And how much of a connection is there between our attitudes and actual kind of the source text, right? That we often kind of, interpret in certain ways. And so it's amazing how, I think it was one official or judge above her who actually had this kind of progressive way of thinking and went back to the source text and realized there's really nothing in here that says that a woman can't serve in this capacity. And so,
and what are the advantages to having a woman serve in this capacity then?
Right.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Well, I found this really an inspiring documentary. The last film from last week is The Sea Inside. This is starring Javier Bardem, who we've seen earlier in the semester in Beautiful. He's really quite an amazing actor.
Yeah, he has quite a range as an actor, as we've seen. And he's playing Ramon San Pedro, who is when he was younger, this is a biographical story here, but it's based on Ramon's experience as a quadriplegic. He was injured early on, I think in his 20s, in a diving accident, and then spent 28 years basically fighting for the right to take his own life, for euthanasia. And I think the film, in some ways, you know, you go into the film thinking that it's going to be about disability, and it really isn't the focus of the film. It seems to be more about his role as an activist. And what's interesting about the film is that he's kind of a flat character in a sense. He doesn't really change. And it's more the people around him who are inspired by him, and not so much inspired by his overcoming his disability, which is often the story in films about disability. There's a certain kind of life-affirming way in which the characters overcome their hardships in kind of that humanistic way. This film is humanistic, but it's more about how he, as an activist, wins, or doesn't win the right, but fights for that right to be able to take his own life. And so in that way, it kind of goes against your expectations of it, but still kind of a humanistic story in that sense of kind of taking control of your life. But he becomes a source of inspiration, and it's more his determination to kind of win this right, more than his overcoming his disability. There's some really fabulous scenes that they kind of meld fantasy and reality in interesting ways. But there's some really fabulous scenes of him kind of just taking flight of his bed. And at first you're thinking, okay, well, this is kind of how he's coped, and this is, you know, the world. He has this kind of rich world of imagination that allows him to kind of deal with the reality of his condition. But you get a sense that really this is what he's missed, and that the disability is not something that he wants to kind of continue to live with, that he wants to win the right to take his life. And so...
So self-determination kind of takes over from... I mean, in our week about disability and creativity, it was right. All about how kind of creativity, you know, like you're saying, helps to overcome, you know, in some ways, limitations.
Strangely enable... creativity, yeah.
But here it's more about the more core principle of self-determination, which is what creativity is ultimately about as well, right?
Yeah. And so he is an inspiration, but it's an inspiration for maybe a different reason than you'll often see in films that deal with this kind of disability. So,
yeah. Well, these were our films from last week. Now we'll turn to preview the films for the coming week. And it's our animation week. It's a somewhat shortened week because of the General Conference of the Church that takes out our Saturday screenings. So this week we're going to be showing Azur et Asmar, Michel Oslo, French and classical Arabic. It's interesting, it's not straightforward Arabic, but it's actually they're speaking classical Arabic in this animated film from 2006. Then we have Mirai, a Japanese film by Mamoru Hosoda from 2018. This has gotten a lot of really positive attention. And then lastly, our documentary Invisible Hands by Shay C. Tandon in English from 2018, looking at the question about the widespread use of child labor in global supply chains. Azur et Asmar is an original fairy tale, in this case inspired kind of loosely by folklore, particularly 1001 Nights. But what really sets this film apart is the way that Oslo draws on the decorative art of North Africa and the Middle East. It's really a stunning computer animation that he used. This is his fourth feature film. The film that he's best known for prior to this film, actually a series of films that feature the character Kirikou. So Kirikou and the Sorceress is the best known of this, which is set in Africa. So again, he kind of draws on these other traditions. And was an enormously popular film in France. It didn't break through as much here in the United States because there was a problem with ratings, that it would have garnered probably a PG-13 rating insofar that Kirikou is running around. I mean, it's set in Africa. He's like a little small, he's born talking, you know, he has these kind of superpowers, right. You know, kind of thing, but he's naked. Huh. And the women are topless, as of course they are in parts of Africa. And so that, you know, American audiences have a little bit harder time dealing with this kind of non-sexual nudity. And so it didn't play quite as well as a children's film. And it is, you know, really, you know, geared towards children. So it didn't really find the same kind of audience. But in Europe, it was enormously popular. And this is an interesting follow-up to that. The basic plot here is that it begins in Europe in the Middle Ages. And he draws in the early part of the film on early Netherlandish painting. to kind of develop this aesthetic, and you have these two boys, Azur and Asmar, and they're both being raised by a nanny from, well, sorry, Asmar's mother is the nanny for Azur, and she's from North Africa. And so he grows up, you know, learning Arabic words and things, but at a certain point, she's driven from the house. But in the meantime, Azur has been filled with all these stories that she's told. And so as he gets older, he goes off in search of the gene. And it takes him to what is presumably North Africa. And then what's very clever about the film is the way that we're invited to see this foreign culture through Azur's eyes. Mm. But Azur is the foreigner, right, in this country. And he is persecuted because he has blue eyes and fair hair. And so, you know, the tables are kind of turned from how we typically see the stranger. There's a wonderful character, Krapo, who we understand that he's probably from Europe. And he's the kind of the commentator, you know, always talking about how, you know, even when he's looking at these incredibly beautiful things in this country, about how awful they are, right? And we can only see it as being really ironic. And the film is ultimately about transcending differences in a lot of ways. Oslo talked about this film. He said, I wanted to talk about immigrants in society. So in my fairy tale, the dirty immigrant is the white blonde with blue eyes. Mm-hmm. And so turning the tables that way, I think, is really important. It's also significant that the Arabic, I mentioned this is classical Arabic that's being spoken, is not translated in the film. That it's, we don't get subtitles for it. That so we are in that position of not fully understanding all the time and being a little bit disoriented. Great story, but ultimately what's the best about this film, I think, are the visuals. Mm. It is just, he really draws on the really complex, intricate geometric patterns of early Islamic art that is just stunning. I mean, it's the colors and the patterns are really overwhelmingly beautiful. And to see this on the big screen, I think, will be a real treat.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to contrast that style of animation with Japanese animation, Mirai, and obviously, you know, animation is kind of being this really visual medium, and what role that plays in storytelling, I think, is be interesting to think about with these two films.
Yeah.
So Mirai is Mamoru Hosoda, who is in kind of maybe the next, or one of the candidates to replace Miyazaki, although that's kind of, you know, large, big shoes.
Everyone
to
wants
fill,
right? to fill those shoes, right?
But he's one that has risen up recently. He's had a few pretty well-known films over the last few years. Summer Wars is probably one of his most recent
ones.
And
we showed that semester or two ago.
Here as well. Mirai is a family story, and a lot of his films focus on the family. But it's, speaking of trauma, it's probably the most traumatic experience that any four-year-old could experience in his family, which is a new baby coming into the house. And, you know, in some ways, how does that change his perspective on things? Mirai actually means future in Japanese. And so what happens through the power of animation, he gets a glimpse of his future and his future of his young sister. And it kind of changes his perspective on his family and himself. Something to really pay attention to in this animation is the way in which Mamoru is well known for actually still hand drawing a lot of his work. But he also relies on a lot of CGI and the way in which they present kind of contrasting styles in the film, that CGI is almost more kind of fantastical and used in kind of fantasy sequences, whereas the hand-drawn stuff is more kind of realistic or kind of associated with more realistic scenarios. So,
and interesting that this is a film about the future. You know,
the
is
future,
that
yeah.
What will be the future, right? I mean, Miyazaki made a big deal of holding on to this hand-drawn aesthetic, right?
Right, yeah. And I think that's what's interesting about animation, I think in general, is that you see these tensions with the medium and with the tradition playing themselves out in the stories, right? That the stories are really about moving past tradition or collaboration and things like that, which is really kind of at the heart of creating animation.
Well, I always think it's interesting, too, that one of the advantages of these international films that we're able to see is how they'll take up a question like the family, and it'll help us to understand how culturally bound sometimes our understandings of these concepts are, that what a family is in America is not or what it means to have blood relations or adoptive relations, or you know, these kinds of things are not what that necessarily means in Japan or in Italy, as we were talking about before, that it helps to open up vision a little bit, and usually in the direction of being more inclusive, which I think is helpful.
Yeah, get us out of our way of thinking in some ways. So.
The third film for next week is Invisible Hands. This is a film, as I mentioned, about child labor and eradicating child labor around the world. It's made by a journalist, Sherasi Tandon, and is really a good work of journalism. That I think that that's what really stands out. That is a, you know, as a film, it's, I don't know that there's anything that particularly distinguishes it as a documentary with new style or form, but it is really good journalism, and it's kind of spanning the globe in all kinds of interesting ways. On Thursday, April 4th at 5 p.m., we're going to be having a post-screening discussion that will be led by Ben Gibbs from our Department of Sociology, which I think should be interesting in shedding some light on this. This is one of the first documentaries that really exposes the problems associated with child labor and child trafficking within the supply chains of some of the world's biggest corporations. And one of the things that really comes out is that there's a willful ignorance on the part of a lot of corporations about how children are being used in different parts of their supply chain. And the way that they shield themselves actually from this knowledge that they don't always want to know, right? It's very difficult to know. I mean, it takes a lot of proactive work. The title, of course, is in reference to Adam Smith's Invisible Hand, right? The invisible hand of the market, of capitalism that propels things forward. And something that it reminds us, two major things in my mind. One is that capitalism at best is amoral. It's not inherently immoral, but it's amoral, right? And the morality in the market comes when we put it there.
Right.
And that takes effort. The market's not going to do that itself. It's has other priorities and principles. And, you know, leading to the second point, which is that we exist in this incredibly complex global network, which means that choices in everyday life here in Provo, Utah, potentially affect people on the other side of the globe in ways that they never have before. And for me, I teach a lot of classes dealing with these kinds of issues, and they're uncomfortable issues. There's a way that it can be paralyzing. It's like, well, what can I do? If anything I do, you know, buy or...
If you go too deep into the rabbit hole, right?
Yeah, no, that there's this kind of complicity that's paralyzing in some ways. But at the same time, it's really important for us to know about these issues. And this is one of the most important issues that I think our documentaries are raising this semester, is that, you know, how are our brothers and sisters being treated in different parts of the globe? And in what ways am I complicit in that? Knowledge is power.
It's complicated, yeah, because you're crossing boundaries and borders and national boundaries and economic, and it gets really complicated along the way. So.
Yeah, exactly. Well, thank you for being part of our discussion today on From the Booth. You can find out more about each of these films by visiting the International Cinema website, ic.byu.edu. where you can catch more about upcoming films, lectures, and events at IC, as well as podcasts about previous week's films. From the Booth is produced by the International Cinema Program, who gets its steadfast support from the BYU College of Humanities. Nevertheless, the hosts of this podcast are solely responsible for the opinions and ideas expressed here, as they don't necessarily represent any official position adopted by the college, university, or our supporting institutions. We thank our sound engineer, Joseph Hegstrom Pratt, for helping us to sound our best, as well as the staff of the BYU Humanities Resource Center and the college web team for vital logistical support. We hope you'll join us next week when, once again, we'll be discussing and previewing the films at International Cinema. Thank you, Mark. We're glad you made it home safe.
Thank you very much. Glad to be back.
Until then, we hope to see you in 250 of the Kimball Tower.
See you again.